While Monica and her family were still in hiding from the press, her lawyer was on TV more than I was. There was a Sunday when he appeared on the talk shows of all the networks, one right after the other. I think it was a world record. Countless articles and reports were appearing about Monica and her family, most of them unflattering. Ginsburg was trying to shoot them down. He was also trying, so far unsuccessfully, to get Monica immunity. Finally, in February, her father felt it was time to speak out. Thanks to Ginsburg, he decided to speak to me. It would be the first big get of the story. He didn't want to do the interview at his home in Los Angeles, so we rented a suite in a relatively quiet hotel and managed to keep the interview under wraps until it was done. Bernard Lewinsky had been characterized as a fabulously wealthy Beverly Hills doctor, but in fact was a hard-working cancer specialist whose practice wasn't even in Beverly Hills. He was also a private man who was devastated by the prurient press coverage of his daughter. Like Monica, he was outraged that the independent counsel had forced his ex-wife, Marcia Lewis, to testify to a grand jury where she might possibly incriminate her daughter. Monica had been staying with her father in Los Angeles, and together, on February 11th, they watched as camera showed Monica's mother being helped out of the courthouse after she collapsed under the stress of the questioning. In his interview with me, Dr. Lewinsky said, "What Ken Starr has brought upon her is unconscionable in my mind. To pit a mother against her daughter, to coerce her to talk, is reminiscent to me of the McCarthy era, of the Inquisition, and you could even stretch it and say the Hitler era." The interview aired on 2020 on February 20th, 1998, and Dr. Lewinsky's comparison of the Starr inquiry with Hitler's tactics attracted a lot of attention and some criticism. But many felt the interview finally put a human face to the name Lewinsky and helped people understand more about the pressure the family was under. It also gave me a leg up in trying to eventually get the interview with Monica. Her father was satisfied with our interview and now trusted me to be fair and accurate. Meanwhile, Monica remained a shut-in, unable to talk with her friends or venture outside without fear of being descended upon by hordes of media. When she did go out, she was often the subject of unflattering photos and cruel nicknames based on her weight, such as Tubby Temptress and Portly Pepper Pot. Anytime she stopped at a deli or ate at a restaurant, reports appeared of everything she supposedly consumed. As William Ginsburg was the only direct point of contact to Monica, journalists went all out to court him. I seemed to be ahead of the game, but I also played every card I could. Time magazine was about to throw a huge gala, celebrating its 75th anniversary. It was going to be attended by everyone from President Clinton to Tom Cruise. I was invited, along with every major journalist, and as I was allowed to bring a guest, I asked Ginsburg. He was delighted, but because Clinton was there, I found that my table was at the rear of the room while the dignitaries, stars, and well-known journalists, including most of my colleagues, were seated ringside. So, I had a lousy time, but I thought, oh well, it may pay off later. But don't think I was the only one romancing Ginsburg. The competition was getting more and more fierce. Once when I called Ginsburg, he was having dinner with Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. Ginsburg told me of one of my colleagues who offered to introduce Monica's father, a photography enthusiast, to famed photographer Richard Avedon. Ginsburg himself was receiving countless dinner invitations, in addition to tickets to the theater and special events. He recognized what it was all about, and though he took it all with a grain of salt, he was flattered by the attention. In spite of my not enjoying the time party, all was going well for me with Ginsburg. We were by now developing a quite friendly relationship. In April 98, I found myself in the enviable position of being the first and only reporter to have a private meeting with Monica. If I had reason to be in California, Ginsburg told me, he might arrange for me to drop by Dr. Lewinsky's house. That was reason enough for me to go to California. Ginsburg brought me to the Lewinsky home in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles. ironically just blocks away from the site where Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman had been murdered 4 years before. It was a fairly modest home in which Dr. Lewinsky lived with his second wife, Barbara, the walls decorated mainly with photographs he had taken. When Monica entered the room, you would have thought she had nothing pressing on her mind. She was smiling and cheerful. My first thought was that she was prettier than she appeared in photographs. She had beautiful skin, shiny black hair, and although she was somewhat heavy, she was far from obese. She was what my grandmother would have described as zoftig, which sort of means plump in a good way. Monica had been shopping and had bought some new hats. She happily tried them on for me, and they were very becoming. I was reminded of the beret photograph. Monica told me that her stepmother had taught her how to knit, and that had helped her pass the time while her legal fate was still in jeopardy. Before the knitting, she had spent most of the time watching television and surfing the internet for information about her case. This was the only time on my visit that we discussed the case. I didn't want to say anything at this first meeting she might take offense at. I was impressed that she wasn't whining or crying over what had happened to her. I remarked that I knew how difficult all this must be for her. She said that she had never been involved in any scandal before. "I was basically a good kid growing up," she told me. "I didn't smoke or take drugs. I had good grades and never shoplifted." I told her, "Next time, shoplift." She laughed, and I felt we had the beginning of a relationship. Monica later told me that my offhand remark meant a great deal to her. She said it showed I had a sense of humor. "It is humor," she said, "that got me through a lot of the pain. It's how I connect with people." But she was still a long way from being able to give an interview. As the independent counsel continued his investigation, she lived in constant fear of being arrested. Her father shared her fears. After 6 months with no immunity deal, and irritated by all the time Ginsburg was spending talking to the press, Dr. Lewinsky and Monica fired him. On June 2nd, they replaced him with two Washington insiders, Plato Cacheras and Jacob Stein. I liked Ginsburg personally, but that was that for my Monica-Ginsburg relationship. Onward. As it happened, I knew both of the new lawyers from two controversial and newsworthy interviews I had done with former clients. Cacheras had represented Fawn Hall, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's beautiful blonde secretary, who had smuggled potentially incriminating documents in the Iran-Contra case out of the office in her underwear, and Stein had worked for Senator Bob Packwood, who had faced accusations by 29 women, all former employees or acquaintances, of sexual misconduct. Both clients had told me they were pleased with my interviews, considering them very fair. This, I hoped, would help. We called and wrote the new legal team, but by that time, the Lewinskys had hired an experienced and respected spokeswoman, Judy Smith, to handle media inquiries. This is the same Judy Smith I've already mentioned, whose PR firm handled Saudi Arabia. We were together there for weeks, and she was very good at what she did. I arranged a meeting with her to discuss Monica, but Judy was noncommittal, and I began to worry about my prospects. Finally that summer, Monica's new lawyers were able to work out a deal for her to get transactional immunity, which meant that she would not be prosecuted for anything related to the case in exchange for cooperating fully with the independent counsel and testifying truthfully. By the end of July, Monica turned over the infamous stained blue Gap dress, which testing revealed did contain the president's DNA. That August, with her immunity intact, she testified to a grand jury that she did have a sexual relationship with the president, even though she had denied it in her affidavit in the Paula Jones lawsuit. She was forced to disclose in detail every meeting and conversation with the president. 11 days later, on August 17th, Bill Clinton became the first sitting American president to testify to a federal grand jury about his own conduct. The testimony was given over closed-circuit television from the White House, but of course it leaked out. After months of denials, he admitted to inappropriate intimate contact and inappropriate sexual banter with Monica Lewinsky. He denied, however, that he and Monica had sexual relations since, he said, they never had sexual intercourse. To Clinton, and later it seemed to Monica, only actual intercourse constituted sexual relations. The president also denied committing perjury, tampering with evidence, or asking others to lie under oath. In a 4-minute address to the nation that night, he confessed, "I misled people, including even my wife. I regret that." But, and this was important, he didn't apologize to Monica or her family. Monica later told me in our interview that Clinton's speech that night had made her feel like a piece of trash, someone who had just serviced him. After that address, cameras captured Clinton, his wife, daughter, and dog Buddy boarding the presidential helicopter to fly off for a vacation on Martha's Vineyard. The uncomfortable image was of Chelsea Clinton walking in between her parents, holding their hands. The president's admission didn't help Monica. By now, she was the butt of every comedian's joke. Finally, on September 9th, armed guards delivered independent counsel Kenneth Starr's report and its 18 boxes of accompanying material to the House of Representatives. 2 days later, Starr's report was released to the public. For almost 500 pages, it described in virtually pornographic fashion every encounter Monica Lewinsky had with President Clinton. Could anything have been more mortifying to either of them? The Starr report became a bestseller, and still hoping I might be doing an interview with Monica, I was one of the people who read every page of it. I thought it was horrendous and unnecessarily graphic. It didn't need 500 pages to make its point. I felt very sorry for Monica and even for the president, who was obviously suffering while still trying to run the country. The morning the report came out, President Clinton, at a Washington, D.C. prayer breakfast, for the first time publicly apologized to Monica Lewinsky and her family, including them in a list of people he acknowledged hurting. Monica never wanted to testify about her relationship with the president, but after being forced to do so in such detail, she now thought she was free of the independent counsel, the grand jury, and the FBI. Ready to move on with her life, she began to think seriously about giving an interview. She wanted to tell her own story in her own words. But she had another consideration: huge legal bills. By the end, a whole team of attorneys was working on the case. Monica said that at some point, her legal fees were $15,000 a day, and as a result, she owed more than $1 million. Her mother and four of her friends who had testified before the grand jury had also accrued legal bills. Monica wanted to pay it all back. Her family also realized that she would need money for her own living expenses. She had become so notorious that finding a regular job would be difficult, if not impossible. Monica now faced a very difficult decision. It is the policy of network news divisions in the United States not to pay for interviews. That is not the case in many foreign countries, like the UK. There were also U.S. talk and interview shows not under news departments that would pay plenty for her first interview, as would many magazines. What would she do? I hadn't seen or talked to Monica since our meeting at her father's house almost 5 months earlier. I heard that she and Judy Smith were meeting with many different journalists. I never knew who they were. For obvious reasons, everyone kept the meetings private. Meanwhile, Monica's family had enlisted the help of a friend, Richard Carlson, a former television journalist and director of The Voice of America. Carlson worked quietly behind the scenes with Monica, going through bags of mail requesting interviews, appearances, and even endorsements. One food company wanted Monica to do a commercial for their coffee creamer, wearing a navy blue Gap dress and complaining, "Oh no, not again," when the product spilled on her. I began to hear about huge deals being offered. It was reported that Rupert Murdoch was dangling some $5 million for a package that included 2 television interviews for his Fox network, one to be shown here on the Fox channel, another with a British broadcaster to be seen internationally. In addition, he was offering a book deal with a publishing company he owned, and Lord knows what else. This was never confirmed, but there was no doubt that Monica could sell her first exclusive interview for all kinds of money. This was not the first time, or the last, that someone in the headlines has had to make that kind of a decision. I will digress for a moment to talk of Paris Hilton. In June 2007, the young woman was serving time in jail for, among other things, driving with a suspended license. At that time, I had a great many conversations with Paris's mother and with Paris herself, who called me from jail. I assumed that I would be doing the first interview with her. But as it turned out, Paris's father, Rick Hilton, was asking for money. Both NBC and ABC found ways of paying the family by purchasing personal photographs and videos of Paris. This was not uncommon practice. However, ABC offered much less money than NBC. The network felt the amount it was offering was legitimate, but the six-figure amount that Rick Hilton was asking for was not. Rick Hilton then told me that NBC had offered so much money that ABC was, in his words, not in the galaxy, and therefore the interview with Paris would be done by that network. When I said I thought Paris's credibility might be a factor, he answered that it was too much money to turn down. Eventually, when news of the NBC offer leaked out, it made extremely unpleasant headlines, and the network withdrew from the deal. The family then offered the interview to me for no money, but by then, the whole thing seemed shoddy to me, and I turned it down. My network stood by my decision. Paris finally did an interview with Larry King, which was fine if bland, but her tarnished reputation was not helped by her family's push for money. Of course, the Paris Hilton negotiations were long after my discussions with Monica, but the situation was similar, money versus credibility. With this predicament, I turned to David Weston, the president of ABC News. David himself, a highly regarded attorney, had first come to ABC as its legal counsel. We discussed Monica's need for money and the fact that her family, specifically her mother, Marcia Lewis, felt that her daughter should accept one of the big deals being offered so that Monica could free herself from debt. David suggested we meet with Mrs. Lewis, and we arranged to get together in the office of a new attorney for Monica, an entertainment lawyer named Richard Hofstetter. As it turned out, I also knew him well from past negotiations. I had also previously been in touch with Marcia Lewis. We had talked several times on the phone. I liked her, and she was not at all the way she was being described by the press. She had been much maligned as a flashy, spoiled Beverly Hills socialite and castigated for supposedly not stopping her daughter's relationship with the president. By some accounts, she had actually encouraged it. Mrs. Lewis had recently married a man I knew, R. Peter Strauss, who owned a string of newspapers and radio stations in New York. Peter, a widower, was a distinguished man. I could not imagine that he would have married a woman of Marcia Lewis's description. I telephoned Peter, and it was he who had put me in touch with his wife. On the phone, she was soft-spoken and polite. The last thing she seemed to want was exposure. Although she could certainly have sold her own story to help offset both her own and her daughter's legal bills, she was turning down all requests for interviews, including mine. Indeed, she never sold her story to anyone. In my conversations with Marcia, she seemed concerned only with her daughter's welfare. When David Weston and I met with her, Marcia called Monica, who was in California, and the three of us talked by speakerphone. David and I said together that Monica could indeed make a lot of money right now. We did not underestimate that. But over and above the money was the matter of her damaged reputation and her future credibility. For the rest of her life, we said, her credibility should be her major concern. Somehow she would find the money to pay her legal bills. I fully believed what we were saying. Of course, I wanted to do the interview, but I was not so ambitious that I didn't have a conscience. It was at this meeting that David came up with a most important compromise. He reiterated that ABC could not pay Monica any money for the interview, but that the network would agree to air it just once, and only in the United States and Canada. If Monica then wanted to do an interview for money for the international market, she could do it right after hours. If she was paid for that interview, it would be none of our business. No one in Europe would have seen our interview, and this meant the interest overseas would be huge. No decision was made in Hofstetter's office, but David and I left hopeful. Monica and I continued to talk on the phone. By this time, Monica was no longer being represented by Judy Smith. In one conversation, Monica told me that her mother had tried repeatedly to get her away from President Clinton, but that from an early age, she had been hard to control. As she said later in our interview, "I'm stubborn. From the time I was 2 years old, one of my first phrases was, with hands on my hips, 'You are not the boss of me.' I've been that way ever since." Monica still had that same determination. Despite all the people who had advised her, she was pretty much going to make her own decision. That fall, Monica accepted an invitation to come to my apartment for dinner. She had evidently met with the other journalists, and it seemed that I was the front runner, but the question of credibility and no payment versus selling her story for big money still loomed ahead. The decision had not been made. Monica arrived, wearing a long black skirt and dark glasses, and brought me a very nice scarf she had knitted. When I had seen her knitting at her father's house, she reminded me of Madame Defarge from Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, who stitched the names of the people she thought should be executed during the French Revolution. "Are you knitting the names of people you want to destroy?" I asked her, but I don't think she knew what I was talking about. Monica was warm and funny, the kind of girl who gives you hugs. I introduced her to Ecodel, and Monica hugged her, too. Whenever I talked with her after that, she always asked me about Ecodel. At dinner, I brought up the money issue in the most forceful way. "Look," I said, "you are going to have to do a major interview. It will have to be truthful and probably painful to do. But you can come out as a woman who cares about the truth and has tried to be honest, or you can be seen as the person many people want to believe you are, an opportunist greedy for fame and money. That is essentially your choice. I can give you the forum and the opportunity to present yourself with the greatest dignity." That was it. I couldn't make the case anymore. Whatever would happen, would happen. I didn't hear from Monica for over a month. Then in November, she called to say she would like to meet the people who might be working on her interview. I asked her to lunch at my apartment. With me were Phyllis McGrady, the ABC News Vice President of Special Projects, and producers Martin Clancy and Katie Thompson. Monica brought some of her knitting to show us. Each item had a cute label that said, "Made especially for you by Monica." We joked that the label made her knitting worth a lot of money. I also admired an upholstery tote bag that she used to carry her yarn and needles, and she told us that she had made the bag herself, finding the vintage fabric and sewing it together. Later, she launched a small and ultimately unsuccessful business selling similar upholstery bags. I don't like to spend too much time with subjects before an interview, as answers don't seem fresh if the person has already told them to me. So at our meeting, whenever Monica began to discuss something that could be a part of our hoped-for interview, I tried to cut her off. But she was so anxious to speak freely that it was difficult to stop her. Besides, we were fascinated. She told us details about the infamous blue dress. Up until then, it had been hard for us to understand why she would keep a soiled dress. She said that she had lots of clothes because of her fluctuating weight. After she gained some weight, she didn't like the way the Gap dress looked on her. To save money, she usually didn't pay to dry clean her clothes until just before she was going to wear them. When she finally decided to wear the dress again, she showed it to Linda Tripp. Then she noticed the stain and told Linda, and I will never forget these words, she figured it was either from Bill Clinton or it was spinach dip. Spinach dip, for heaven's sake. Had it been spinach dip, Clinton would never have been impeached. If I were writing a different kind of book, this would be the place to put in a good recipe for spinach dip. I did ask Monica why she had to give so much detail of every sexual encounter in her testimony. She said people didn't realize she had told not just Linda Tripp about the president, but 10 other people, including her mother and her aunt. The independent counsel had questioned all of them. If her testimony differed from theirs, she could be accused of lying, lose her immunity, and be prosecuted. During lunch, we discussed the kind of promotion we would do. We would not show Monica's answers, only her face and our questions, and in our ads and promotion, we would keep a sense of decorum. When the lunch was over, Monica finally, at last, said that she would do her first interview with ABC. That meant no money. To take the high road and turn down millions of dollars in order to prove her credibility was a great act of courage. I don't think Monica ever got full credit for that. There were still hurdles, but now, almost a year after the story broke, after months of my cultivating contacts, consulting with representatives, meeting with members of her family, and slowly gaining her trust, Monica agreed to break her silence with me. I believed in my heart that I could do the best possible interview for her. After the lunch, I asked Martin Clancy to walk Monica home, and although they only strolled together a few blocks down Madison Avenue, Martin found himself described as Monica's mystery man. The supermarket tabloid The Star had a large photo identifying him as Monica's Santa, and exclaimed that they went on a Manhattan shopping spree, and everything was bought on his credit card. The article went on to say, "It seemed like a lovely romantic day out on the town together." We laughed at this, of course, but it meant we had to take every means to keep our future interview a secret until absolutely every issue was resolved. Strangely enough, Monica had been having trouble reaching an agreement with an American publisher for a book deal. A lot of publishers felt her story had already been told in the Star report. But on November 16, 1998, it was announced that Monica Lewinsky would be telling her story to Andrew Morton, the British author who in 1992 had collaborated with Princess Diana on a best-selling book about her unhappy marriage. The book deal was worth more than $1 million to Monica, easing her financial burden. Then I got a call from Freddie DeMann, an entertainment executive who had previously managed the careers of Madonna and Michael Jackson. He was the father of one of Monica's best friends from Beverly Hills. He asked if Monica did the interview with me, could the book come out in conjunction with the interview? David Weston agreed that the book could come out right after my interview. We would help promote it, and indeed, as it turned out, there were passages from it that I had to read during my interview. We had promised to help Monica where we could, and we did. We couldn't pay her, but we wouldn't stand in the way of her making money as long as it didn't affect my interview. The next month, Monica agreed to do a paid interview for England's Channel 4. She earned something like $600,000 for an interview with British broadcaster Jon Snow, which was then sold to stations around the world. Monica also was paid another $500,000 for a photo spread in Hello Magazine, a popular European publication. Not a bad payday, but millions less than she would have made had she sold her first television interview. As soon as we had Monica's agreement, we began work on the interview. I read the hundreds of pages of transcripts of those Linda Tripp tapes, but that was just the beginning. I also reread the Star report and skimmed through the supplemental evidence that had been released. Plus, I read the grand jury testimony of the key players in the case and various speeches President Clinton had made. The volume of material seemed endless. I read practically all day and all night for weeks. Fortunately, I had help from some of our best producers, not just Martin and Katie, but Chris Vlasto, who helped break the Lewinsky story. We didn't want the questions to sound too tawdry, and yet this was a story about sex, so we worked hard to maintain some kind of balance. Katie opened up one meeting by musing, "I've been in the White House many times, and I don't understand how someone could flash her underpants to the president. The very first question we wrote was this. You lifted the back of your jacket and showed the president of the United States your thong underwear. Where did you get the nerve? I mean, who does that? An early pass contained more than 200 questions. My hard-working assistant, Monica Caulfield, put each of them on my usual index cards. Throughout the Lewinsky affair, we had to refer to her as the original Monica to avoid confusion with our interview subject. I then cut the questions down to the ones I felt were vital to ask. We were chugging right along when we hit a snag. More than a snag, we hit an iceberg. It turned out that our interview was not going to happen anytime soon. Unbeknownst to us, Monica still had to gain permission from the independent counsel to speak to us, something that proved far more difficult than we had anticipated. Monica's immunity agreement said that, pending a final resolution of this matter, Monica could not speak to representatives of the news media without first obtaining the approval of the Office of the Independent Counsel. She was free to collaborate on a book and accept all kinds of money from a non-news show, no matter how sleazy, but she could not speak to ABC News without permission. To do an interview with me could violate Monica's immunity agreement, which meant that the independent counsel could still prosecute her. ABC then began to reach out to anyone they could in Ken Starr's office. By the way, Monica had never then or ever since met Ken Starr. Weeks dragged on without approval. The independent counsel felt that a final resolution of the matter had not occurred since Congress had not yet decided the president's fate. David Weston was tremendously helpful in this matter and in all our negotiations. He considered enlisting the aid of famed First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams to file a lawsuit to overturn the ban on Monica giving the interview. The independent counsel knew we meant business. In December 1998, the House voted to impeach President Clinton on two articles, that he perjured himself before the grand jury and that he obstructed the administration of justice. He vowed not to resign. We had now written and rewritten our questions more than a dozen times, but the year ended with no Monica Lewinsky interview. In January 1999, the Senate impeachment trial began, along with the promise from the independent counsel's office that once the trial was over, they would no longer stand in the way of Monica doing an interview. Our new concern was that Monica had been subpoenaed to give testimony, which would be shown to the public. Though her physical image was very familiar, it was the first time the public heard her voice. Her answers were brief, and we hoped they wouldn't quell our audience's appetite for our interview. They didn't. On February 12th, in only the second impeachment vote in its history, the U.S. Senate acquitted Clinton of both articles of impeachment. 4 days later, the independent counsel sent Monica's lawyers a letter granting her permission to give me an interview. They imposed three restrictions, only one of which affected us. Monica was forbidden to say anything about the conduct of the prosecutors or their investigation, including the terrible day she was detained in a hotel room and interrogated after she met Linda Tripp at the mall. But there was no such restriction placed on me. As I had already received a copy of Monica's about-to-be-published book, I decided in my broadcast just to read the book's description of that night. We wanted to get the interview done quickly so it could air within the crucial sweeps period when network ratings set advertising rates. ABC set the date, Wednesday, March 3rd. We made another decision. There were so many questions to ask and so much interest that we wanted 2 hours. The network, mindful of its second place in the ratings, happily handed over the airtime. All we had to do now was the interview. On the morning of February 20th, with great secrecy and security, we took Monica through the building garage and into 2020's studio. She was 22 when she first met Bill Clinton. She was now 25. She was nervous, but looked very pretty. Her heavy dark hair was pulled off her face. Her lips glistened. She wore a simple black suit, and because she was afraid of looking heavy, We sat her in a chair with arms to cover part of her body. The interview lasted just over 4.5 hours, and the resulting transcript ran to 150 pages. Here are some of the highlights. On our opening question about how she had the nerve to show the president her thong, she said it was a flirtation, a dance. One person does something and then you meet that person and raise the stakes. She described the president as a very sensuous man who has a lot of sensuous feelings. He also has a very strong religious upbringing and struggles with his sensuality. He tries to hold himself back and then can't anymore. She proclaimed that her relationship with Bill Clinton was not just about sex. Everyone will probably find it hard to believe, but when I asked him did he want to get to know me as a person, he started to tear up and told me that he never wanted me to think that he didn't, and that's not what this relationship was about. When I asked her why she thought the president was attracted to her, she said, "He thought that I had a lot of energy and that I lit up a room and that he thought I was smart." She said that after the relationship progressed, she told Clinton that she was in love with him. He responded, "That means a lot to me," but when she asked if he loved her, he said no. She had wanted to have intercourse with him, but when she asked him to, he said, "When you get to be my age, you'll understand that there are consequences for those kinds of things." She then told me, "I got really upset, because to me that completes a relationship, and now I would never know what it was like to be that intimate with him." Later, when she was officially banned from the White House, weeks, sometimes months, would go by without her seeing him. The almost nightly telephone calls stopped coming. Clinton tried to break up with her, but she refused to walk away and continued to try to see him. "Where was your self-respect?" I asked. "Where was your self-esteem?" Her answer was very sad. "I don't have feelings of self-worth that a woman should have," she said. "And I think that's been the center of a lot of my mistakes and a lot of my pain." She showed the most emotion when talking about the toll the investigation and all the media attention had taken on her family. She said that not only was she suicidal at certain points, her parents had also felt great despair. With tears filling her eyes, she lamented, "People have no idea what this has done. That behind the name Monica Lewinsky, there's a person and there is a family, and there's been so much pain that has been caused by all this. It was so destructive." As for the notorious dress, she said she put it in a closet at her mother's apartment, and her mother didn't even know it was there. Then she said that even though Ken Starr's people didn't actually know she had the dress, she nevertheless turned it over to them. I asked why. "Because I had to. Getting and keeping my immunity became very important to me. I had to tell the truth about absolutely everything, including the dress. For if they found it, I might be brought up on charges of perjury." "This dress," she continued, "is one of the most humiliating things that has ever happened to me. Every man that I have met since this thing has happened eventually says to me, 'So what is the real story with the dress? I wish I had never had it.'" My final question to her was, "What will you tell your children when you have them?" She replied simply, "Mommy made a big mistake." On the evening of March 3rd, I had the producers of the show and a few friends to my apartment to watch the program. It was an inflammatory evening in more ways than one. I had made a fire, but the flue wasn't open. The room began to fill with smoke, and the fire department came. I was very sad to learn 3 years later that two of those firemen died in the 9/11 attacks. As the show began, I couldn't help but wonder how many people around the country were watching. So many had said, "Oh, I'm not going to watch Monica Lewinsky, that's beneath me." I thought that a lot of them would be true to their word, but at one point I went over to the window and looked down at the street below. There wasn't a car on the avenue. Nothing was moving. Strangely, the biggest question we got after the interview aired was about the shiny lipstick Monica was wearing. ABC received hundreds of phone calls and emails from viewers asking its name. Turned out it was a color called Glaze from a new makeup line by the clothing store Club Monaco. The lipstick quickly sold out around the country. It is now 10 years since the Monica Lewinsky story broke. After her book and interviews, since she couldn't escape it, Monica tried to capitalize on her fame and took some TV jobs. She became a spokesperson for the Jenny Craig diet and then hosted a reality dating program called Mr. Personality on Fox. Nobody wanted to give her a real job. She eventually decided to try to become a private person again and went back to school. In December 2006, she earned a graduate degree from the highly respected London School of Economics. Her thesis was titled In Search of the Impartial Juror, an exploration of the third-person effect and pre-trial publicity. After Monica's graduation, The Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen wrote this about her. It does not take a Freudian to appreciate why Lewinsky chose the topic she did. She is the victim of publicity, and her life has been a trial, enough to floor almost anyone. She is a branded woman. Yet she did what so many women that age would do. She seduced, or so she thought, an older man. Here was her crime. She was a girl besotted. But now she is a woman with a master's degree from a prestigious school. She's going to be 34. Where is the guy brave enough, strong enough, admirable enough to take her as his wife, to say to the world that he loves this woman, even if she will always be an asterisk in American history? I hope there is such a guy out there. It would be nice. It would be fair. The last time I spoke to Monica, I told her that I would be writing about her in this book. She was still trying very hard to get a job. Most of all, she wants, as she has always wanted, to have a husband and a family. I agree with Richard Cohen. It would be nice. It would be fair. The View. In 1997, The View sneaked up on me. The last thing I was thinking about was daytime television. I knew that Oprah Winfrey and Phil Donahue, who were on the air during the day, were each very popular. I had even appeared on their programs. But I had little interest in television until early evening when the news came on. I was fully occupied doing 2020 along with the Barbara Walters specials. By this time, I had been doing 4 specials a year for 20 years with great success, and for most of those years with my producer, Bill Getty. My plate was full. I had no room for gravy. Enter gravy. The 11 a.m. period on ABC, which was controlled by the network and not by syndicators, was floundering. A lot of pleasant people had attempted to do a show during that time period, but no program lasted for more than a year or two. Unlike the earlier morning and late afternoon programs, it was considered a very tough time slot. By 11 a.m., it was thought most non-working women had sent the kids off to school and had finished their housework. It was time to go out and do the marketing, the errands, and maybe pick up the little ones from nursery school. So, sort of in desperation, the daytime network executives, who had nothing to do with the news department executives for whom I worked, came to me and Bill Getty and said, "Got any ideas for a daytime program?" Well, now that they mentioned it, I did have a concept that occasionally drifted through my head. And when the program finally made it to air, here is what I actually said. "I've always wanted to do a show with women of different generations, backgrounds, and views. These women, I imagined, could chat away on all sorts of subjects. Then we could add a celebrity interview or two, perhaps followed by an informative segment on health, fashion, or whatever we deemed of interest to women." It was a relatively simple concept. I had 2 inspirations. The first came from watching the ABC Sunday morning news program, This Week with David Brinkley. Near the end of each hour-long broadcast, Brinkley moderated a roundtable with 3 or 4 other journalists who commented on the latest events in the news. It was informative, free-flowing, and often very amusing. I thought it was the best part of the program. My other inspiration came from a woman named Virginia Graham, who at one time had a modestly successful daytime program called Girl Talk, on which I occasionally appeared, sometimes along with another guest or two. Again, the conversation was unrehearsed, and when it spun off in different directions, it could be a lot of fun. So I wondered if we took a small and varied group of women and made them a permanent cast. Would that work for an informative and entertaining hour? I thought it might. The network was not overly impressed, but said they would consider it enough to have us make a pilot. Furthermore, they insisted that I would have to be one of the women on the panel. Otherwise, they didn't think they could sell the program to advertisers. I told them that if I could appear on the show just two or three times a week and not have to be the daily moderator, I would give it a try. The key, of course, was to choose the right women with the right chemistry. Just a simple thing. Find four smart women of different ages and different personalities who could disagree without killing one another and, better still, might actually like each other. First step. We rented a large hotel suite, outfitted it with comfortable sofas and chairs, brought in cameras, put a mini control center in an adjacent room where, on a television monitor, we could then watch the various applicants talk and see how they related to one another. We would give them a list of subjects from the newspapers that day and let them just go at it. We had talked to dozens of talent agents, and the word got around that we were planning a gab fest with a bunch of women. The result of this was that we were deluged with resumes, phone calls, and tapes. Everybody and her aunt knew the perfect person. All you have to do is talk, the various applicants thought, so why not me? The very first group of four looked promising, but who knew? As a possible moderator, we were considering an attractive woman named Meredith Vieira. Meredith had at one time been a correspondent on 60 Minutes on CBS. But because at the time she had one young child and was pregnant with a second, she didn't want to travel. Don Hewitt, the program's executive producer, felt that all his reporters had to travel to do stories, and he didn't, in all fairness, make an exception for Meredith. So they came to a rather unhappy parting of the ways. More recently, I knew Meredith from ABC, where she was working on a news magazine the network was trying out called Turning Point. Unfortunately, the program didn't make it. Meredith's contract at ABC was not renewed, and she was at loose ends. I checked and heard from her producers that she was not just smart, but almost more important to me, possessed a wicked sense of humor. At first, Meredith wasn't really interested in appearing on a daytime program. Her whole professional life had been on news broadcasts. Why should she take the risk of going on an untried daytime talk show? But her husband, Richard Cohen, who had himself been a news producer at CBS, persuaded her to consider it. It could be fun, he said, and you won't have to travel. She could also be back from the studio before the kids got home from school. What did she have to lose? Score one for our possible moderator. Sitting on the couch next to Meredith was Star Jones, an African-American woman who had been a prosecuting attorney in Brooklyn and distinguished herself first reporting for Court TV and later covering the O.J. Simpson trial for Inside Edition. Star was large in every way, from her resume to her weight to her personality. She was funny and knowledgeable, especially on subjects relating to the law. Her favorite word was allegedly. She was single, in her 30s, and looking for a husband. The reports that Bill and I got were that she was sometimes difficult to work with, but we thought, as part of an ensemble, she would be okay. Then there was the woman we agreed might provide real humor. Her name was Joy Behar. A comedian, she had worked small clubs around town, but was almost unknown to the wider public, including me. One night I went to a benefit honoring Milton Berle, an old family friend whom I have mentioned before. I was sitting next to Regis Philbin when the entertainment began, and on stage came a good-looking redhead who told a joke about the author Salman Rushdie. Rushdie had written a book which some Muslims found blasphemous, and a directive had been issued that he should be killed. As a result, Rushdie was in deep hiding, protected by Scotland Yard. "I'll tell you the difference between men and women," said Behar. "Rushdie has been in solitary confinement for 5 years with no visitors at all allowed, and in that time he's been married twice." Well, It loses something when I tell it, but I thought, this woman is perfect for us. Finally, we auditioned a lively young girl in her 20s who told us that she was appearing occasionally on MTV. Her name was Debbie Matenopoulos. She was kind of ditzy and likable, and we thought she might be just right for the youngest member of the panel. Here is what was so amazing. This group of four was the first panel we tried out in 2 full days of auditions. We thought they were great, but we didn't think we should just go with the first group. So we tried out something like 50 women and mixed them up in different groups of four. Finally, toward the end of the second day, Bill and I looked at each other and said, "You know, the first group was the best. Let's go with Meredith as the moderator and Star, Joy, and Debbie on the panel. I would join the group twice a week on the days I could fit it in among my other assignments." As for the name, we liked The View From Here, but we were told that name was being used by a program in Canada, so we shortened it to The View, and that was that. Bill and I were co-executive producers. Together, we worked out a format based on my original idea. The basis of the program would be the unrehearsed and spontaneous chat sessions among the women. We would call this segment Hot Topics. Essentially, the program still follows that early format. Bill was and is indispensable. He hired a director and a bunch of bright young producers, gave them marching orders, and whipped the show into shape. The producers, most of whom are still with us, start with Alexandra Dusty Cohen, who, as supervising producer, is Bill's right arm. Then there are 2 coordinating producers, Matthew Strauss and Patrick Ignazi. Donald Berman and Sue Solomon are responsible for booking the guests. We also have had, from day one, the talented and creative director Mark Gentile and a wonderful young woman, Fran Taylor, who has managed, no matter what their size or shape, to dress all the cast members. Linda Finson supervises production and the budget of the show. These are just some of the staff who then and now help to make The View a success. We have had very little turnover throughout the years. In the beginning, my job was to do the outside work, which was primarily to deal with the network, the advertisers, the publicity people, and the press. In short, I had to keep us afloat. The View was launched on August 11, 1997. We deliberately put it on when the viewing audiences were at their summer low. This, we felt, would give us a chance to work out the kinks and get used to one another. We felt fresh and new. The set, however, was neither fresh nor new. The network didn't have enough faith in our budding program to invest in a new set. What we inherited was left over from an unsuccessful ABC soap opera called The City. It was located on West 66th Street, next to the Hudson River. A few more steps to your right, and you'd be in the river. One more thing. We were a network program, not syndicated. In syndication, the programs are sold to individual stations all over the country. They can appear on any network or station at any time. For example, Oprah airs at 9 a.m. in Chicago, but at 4 p.m. in New York. Because we are a network program, we are on the air every day during the same time period, 11 a.m. in the East and 10 a.m. everywhere else. When we made our debut, all of the ABC-owned and operated stations were obliged to carry us. There are 10 of them. But at that time of day, stations not owned by ABC but affiliated with the network had the choice of carrying the show or not. What we did not know was that more than 20% of the country would not be carrying the show in the morning time period. Sometimes the affiliates would run it in overnight hours. This included quite a few big cities like Boston, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C., as well as many smaller markets. Other cities like Miami, Pittsburgh, and Milwaukee didn't carry the show at all. Week after week, part of my job was to phone the heads of these various stations, many of whom I knew personally, or their station managers, to try to persuade them to carry The View. It was like the riddle of the chicken and the egg. If we wanted to get big guests to come on the program, we needed ratings to entice them. Therefore, we had to have as many stations carrying us as possible. On the other hand, if we didn't have those big-name guests and the big ratings, the affiliates wouldn't carry us. they would instead stick to their own programs which they felt would do better than The View. But little by little, the viewers got a taste of our program and liked the taste. Over time, our ratings began to rise, and gradually the stations climbed aboard. Today, we have almost 100% coverage. My being involved with the program had other ramifications. I could help book the big-name celebrities. For example, I had interviewed Tom Selleck for one of our specials. He, like the very nice man he is, agreed to be our first celebrity guest. In the first week, we had Michael J. Fox and Sylvester Stallone visiting us, both good pals doing me a favor. In the beginning, the big-name guests only wanted to come on the show when I was on. This occasionally still happens, and I try to be on the program if it is someone I know really well, like Tom Cruise or Michael Douglas. But as the program became more popular, it became easier to book guests whether I was on or not. Our panel knew none of our early concerns. What they knew was that The View was a great opportunity for them. Our first few weeks went surprisingly well. We five women would then, and still do, arrive in the large makeup room at 9 a.m., a full 2 hours before the program goes on the air live. We then receive a sheaf of papers from a researcher with the news stories of the day. Talking and laughing, we decide which subjects we want to tackle. If it starts a discussion, or better still, an argument, we know we are onto something. But we are careful not to leave the argument in the dressing room. We save it for the broadcast, so we can let the chips fall where they may. Then, as now, we loved stories that concerned sex. Surefire winners. I often cringed because I thought they went too far, but Meredith and Joy both had raunchy senses of humor, so vaginas and penises became part of our almost daily vocabulary. I sometimes said, "Enough with the penises!" But the conversations were lively and just shocking enough. Besides, I rather liked my position as the panel prude. Star often had the most to say, and her views were almost always interesting and provocative. She soon became the audience's favorite member of the panel. She was also the one viewers remembered the most, being the only African-American of the group. An extra plus was that as a lawyer, her habit of saying, allegedly, kept us out of trouble. Joy was truly funny. She was also opinionated and very smart. We had made the right choice. Meredith made a terrific moderator. While her hair and makeup were being done, she sat with an assistant and together they wrote all the introductions to whatever the hot topics would be. Her introductions were on the teleprompter, the rest of the hot topics were ad-libbed. However, as charming and funny as Meredith could be, it took the audience a while to identify with her. At first she came across as just another pretty lady. In time, though, the audiences came to realize that she was probably the most outrageous of all of us. One day she would tell us that she didn't wear underwear. The next day she would tease about her three children and tell stories about her cat who peed all over the house. Meredith could get away with almost anything. But she also had her serious side. Her husband Richard has multiple sclerosis and had colon cancer. Meredith talked of this from time to time, although never in a maudlin way. We all talked about personal aspects of our lives. We were a kind of family, sharing our good times and bad. Joy, the viewers learned, was divorced, had a daughter, Eve, and had been living with Steve, a former teacher, for almost 20 years. He was often the butt of her good-natured jokes. Star's dream, she told us, was to marry an African-American Christian man with a good job. She was not, she told us, about to support any man. In the meantime, she discussed her dates. Most of them didn't seem to last, and we secretly prayed that she would meet some real nice guy real soon. We also, as time went on, worried about her increasing weight gain, but none of us had the courage to say anything to her. Star didn't take to criticism easily and could tell us to mind our business, especially because on the air she constantly talked about how much she liked her body. The audience could relate to her, but in retrospect, we should have pushed the matter as she was becoming dangerously obese. I regret that I didn't confront her, although later Star told me she wouldn't have listened anyway. In the early months of the program, of all the women, I shared the least about my life. I was afraid to let go too much on The View because I was known as a serious interviewer on 2020. As a result, I came across as rather reserved, and sometimes I inhibited the others. I worked on this and knew that I was making progress when one day, having made a joking remark, my daughter said, "At last, Mom, people know you have a sense of humor." Part of my reticence to talk about myself was that Rune Arledge, still the president of ABC News and my boss, had been against my doing the program at all. He didn't forbid it, though he could have. Instead, he said that he thought my involvement might take away from my authoritative position in news. This was many years before television journalists were expected to have personalities as well as deliver the news. I thought about it for a while and decided it was a challenge I wanted to take. But Rune's admonition stayed in my mind. Fortunately, as it turned out, the viewers knew me so well from all those years on the air that they were able to accept the fact that I wore two hats. Indeed, I think, as my daughter expressed, the fact that I could have fun and laugh made me more likable to the viewer. So everything seemed to be working. What wasn't working, which is why I left discussing her for last, was Debbie Maitenopoulos. At first she was sweetly lovable, but it quickly became apparent that her life was more about going out to parties than reading a book or a newspaper. As a result, instead of coming across as young and with it, she came across as young and not very well informed. Saturday Night Live began to do skits about Debbie, and although that was a sort of compliment and let a lot of people know that The View even existed, it also led a lot of people to feel that we had a scatterbrain on the program. That is how Debbie came across, and it was amusing only up to a point. Our research showed that she was turning off viewers and affecting the ratings of the program. Finally, in the fall of 1998, a little more than a year after the show went on the air, the network told Debbie that they could not renew her contract. We were personally fond of her and allowed her to say that she was leaving The View to study acting, and we gave her a big going-away party. Debbie officially left on January 6, 1999. In 2006, during our ninth year of The View, Debbie came back as a guest host. She had grown up to be a most charming woman. She was married and a co-host of The Daily 10 on E!, The View had, after all, helped to launch her career, and that made me happy. After Debbie left the show, we were again deluged with tapes, phone calls, letters, people stopping us on the street, all of whom wanted to fill Debbie's position. Every time I got a phone call from someone I hadn't seen in years, I knew it was about the job on The View. Even Michael Eisner, then chairman and CEO of the Walt Disney Company, which owns ABC, had a candidate for us. "Please send a tape," we told him. And we didn't hire the young woman. We thought it would be good if we could find a young Hispanic woman, as we didn't have such a person represented on the program. But we didn't limit ourselves to Hispanics. For 4 months, we tried out new faces on the panel. Finally, after narrowing the list down to 3 young women, we chose not a Hispanic, not an African-American, not another Caucasian, but an American-born Chinese girl named Lisa Ling. She was lovely to look at, very bright, and most important, the chemistry seemed right with the rest of the women. We all felt comfortable with her. Lisa joined The View in May 1999. But almost from her first days, she told me she really wanted to work on a news program. Her opportunity came after she had been with us for 3 years or so, when National Geographic offered her an exciting and demanding position as their roving television correspondent. She was so good that Oprah later hired her as a regular on her program. So alas, in December 2002, Lisa left us. "Here we go again," we said. Contest, tapes, emails. Almost a year after Lisa left, we finally made our choice. And what a great choice it was. We hired 26-year-old Elizabeth Hasselbeck, a survivor of the hit television show Survivor. If Elizabeth could eat worms and stand up to all of the challenges of that show, she could certainly survive us. Elizabeth was married. Her husband is a football player, Tim Hasselbeck. And what's more, to our joy, a year after she joined us, Elizabeth got pregnant. And when her little girl Grace was two, she got pregnant again. In November 2007, her son Taylor Thomas was born. We told Elizabeth that all this was great for our ratings and thanked her for obliging us with babies. Elizabeth also had something else that Bill and I felt was very important to the program. Meredith, and most certainly Star and Joy, were outspoken liberals, especially where politics were concerned. It made the program, in many discussions, lopsided. Elizabeth, perhaps surprising in a young woman just in her 20s, was very conservative and a supporter of George W. Bush, which helped to promote good and lively discussions. In the beginning, Elizabeth had trouble speaking up, but as time went on, she more than held her own, especially when it came to defending Bush's actions in Iraq. So we made it through the first 9 years of the program, and whoever thought the program would last 9 years? Certainly not me. If imitation is considered the sincerest form of flattery, then we certainly should have been flattered. The more successful The View became, the more the program was copied. In the fall of 1999, NBC News put on a program immediately following The Today Show, which featured three women, the best known being Florence Henderson, chit-chatting about the news of the day, followed by interviews. Called Later Today, the program never caught on and lasted only a year. Then in 2001, Dick Clark Productions introduced The Other Half, with Clark himself at the helm, I guess more or less assuming my role. The show had different men, again chit-chatting away, followed by interviews. It was aimed at women, and for a while, given the male point of view, it was mildly amusing. In some cities, the program went on opposite The View, but it did us no harm. The Other Half sputtered along for 2 years, and then it, too, folded. What the producers didn't realize was how vitally important the right chemistry between the co-hosts was. We were either very smart with our choice of cast, or very lucky. In addition, our program was well-produced. We worked for years to get the right balance of talk and guests. Since we were a bunch of women, our approach, our questions, our whole attitude toward celebrities was different. We were looser and more fun, and the guests, male or female, along with plugging their books or movies, enjoyed weighing in on the hot topics they had just heard us discussing. We also made certain that at least one of us had read the book or seen the movie or TV show, and our guests appreciated that. We got the biggest stars to come on. Just plop yourself on our couch and discuss your film and your sex life. It wasn't just show business celebrities who joined us. Over the years, we've had many major political figures sit down on the couch. Here are some. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, John McCain, Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, Ron Paul, Al Sharpton, and Nancy Pelosi. General Colin Powell was with us this year on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and soon after her election, Chile's first female president, Dr. Michelle Bachelet, came on the program. In 2003, I even married New York's mayor, Michael Bloomberg. Well, not exactly. Just for the fun of it, one day, each of us had to pick our dream husband. I chose the mayor, saying he was rich, brilliant, and besides, I thought he was cute. We had a cardboard cutout of him when suddenly, to my surprise, he walked on stage, threw aside the cutout, and we were a couple. The marriage, however, has never been consummated. We had a scare or two. In the spring of 2002, CBS News came after Meredith, offering her a lot more money to join a new early morning lineup that was planning yet another View-like panel. Meredith was tempted, but she didn't really want to chance her future on a brand new show, and she was very happy on The View. In the end, we found a solution. The quiz show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, was starting a syndicated daytime version. I talked to ABC about having Meredith host the program, and they thought it was a great idea. Meredith then got additional income and began another aspect of her career as the host of a quiz show. We breathed a sigh of relief when she turned down the CBS offer. Things began to change in the summer of 2003, however. Star, whose weight was becoming more and more of an issue, decided to take drastic measures. She had reached the point where her heavy breathing was noticeable on the air, and she could barely walk. After consulting her doctors, she decided to have gastric bypass surgery that would shrink her stomach and make overeating uncomfortable if not dangerous. Star was quite sick for several weeks after the procedure and missed some time on the program. We expected her, when she felt well, to talk about the procedure on the air, as it was such an important aspect of her life and could hardly be kept secret. Or so we thought. Star had even told me that she would discuss the whole operation and its aftermath with me on 2020. But after the operation, Star said she didn't want to become what she called a poster child for the procedure and have to answer a lot of questions. I understood that, but it put us all in a terrible position. It meant we virtually had to lie for Star, especially when she said again and again on the air that her weight loss was due primarily to portion control and Pilates. But she was also our colleague, and we felt we couldn't out her. It became more and more difficult to keep up the charade, especially since the program consistently featured segments on diet and weight loss. Joy, in particular, resented having to go along with a lie that implied that all one needed to do was sit-ups and ingest one cookie instead of two. Star, however, had other news that did make us happy. In November, 4 months after her procedure, she was introduced to an attractive, single African-American bachelor named Al Scales Reynolds. Just what she was looking for. We rejoiced for her, and when we met Al at The View's annual Christmas party, we liked him very much. Before long, Star told us that she and Al were to be married the following autumn. Al proposed in front of cameras by getting down on one knee at an all-star NBA basketball game. He gave her a large diamond ring. All the tabloid television programs aired the proposal, and almost every day, someone in our studio audience would shout for Star to show off the ring. These were happy times. Then, a shadow fell. Star came to Bill and me and said that she wanted a very big wedding. It was the one time in her life, she said, that she wanted to feel like a princess. Being royal, however, costs a lot of money, and Star's solution was to try to get what she could for free, like possibly the invitations and flowers and her wedding cake and bridesmaids' dresses, in return for promoting these items on the air. She hoped to do that on The View, but if that was not possible, she said, she would find other programs that would agree. We then did a few segments on her wedding, focusing on the invitations and the wedding gowns, thinking the audience would like it, and they did. But I think we made a great mistake. We should have told her that these free gifts in return for promotion were unacceptable, and that she could not barter them away. We soon stopped the promotions on The View, but we couldn't prevent Star from doing them on other programs, as her contract allowed her to make limited appearances on shows other than The View. But she was beginning to attract bad publicity. As she made more requests or demands, suppliers, or some who were not asked to supply, leaked to the tabloids what she was doing. The New York Post began to call her Bridezilla. It was not a compliment, and it became a national story. We were very distressed about this. Such publicity was not helping our show, and it sure wasn't helping Star. Instead of being the lovable, romantic bride, she was now being seen as the greedy bride. The lavish wedding took place in November 2004, a year after she and Al had met. The over-the-top celebration became even more fodder for the tabloids. Star, who had begun by being the most popular member of our panel, was now rapidly becoming the least popular. Viewers were saying they didn't recognize her anymore. She was beginning to appear false, and Star's popularity had been built on the audience being able to relate to her. At this time, the ABC daytime executives once more conducted focus groups and found that Star was losing us viewers. They warned her agents that they were thinking of not renewing her contract, which would be up in August 2006. They then evidently firmed up their position, because just before Christmas of 2005, they came to Bill and me and told us that they had decided to replace Star on the program. They also wanted us to tell her right away. We hesitated. Not only was it just before Christmas, but Star had written a book called Shine, which was about to be published. In the book, she told readers how she had achieved physical, emotional, and spiritual happiness. She was a changed person, she said. She did not mention the gastric bypass. Star told us that she was going on a multi-city tour for the book. Bill and I felt then that we could not possibly give her bad news at the start of what she hoped would make her book a bestseller. Beyond this, we were genuinely fond of Star. She had been so terrific for so many years on the program, and we were fervently hoping she would turn her image around. Though my opinion mattered, it was the network that did the actual hiring and firing of the talent. We asked the network to hold off on their decision. Finally, in April, ABC told Star's agents that her contract would definitely not be renewed. Bill and I told Star we would protect her career and not let anyone know that she was being fired. She could say she was writing another book, that she wanted to start a new chapter in her life, whatever she wanted to say. We felt we owed her this, and she agreed that this was what should be done.